Pleasure to be here and to have such a full house to address this morning. I am rather used to this in more ways than you might think. My father was a Presbyterian pastor, so I've stood in front of Presbyterian congregations at a lectern since I was about 5 years old. And I tell people in the clinic when they're not hearing quite so well, I said I can make myself heard because of that experience of projecting into a sanctuary, into a fellowship hall. So this is a coming home for me in many ways. Not my first trip to Briarwood, but not my first rodeo of this sort of being in front of a large group in a fellowship hall in a Presbyterian church. So it's a real honor and pleasure to be here with you this morning. There are so many things that we could address in the story of Alzheimer's disease. We could talk about the disease. We could talk about its impact on people. I know that Miller Pigott from Alzheimer's Central Alabama addressed this audience not too long ago. And so rather than focusing on the caregiving issues today and the disease issues, and I'll touch on those, I'm really going to focus primarily on those of us in the room who are currently well and want to stay that way, and to help us understand how we might maintain that cognitive wellness. But I'll be putting that in the context of the most common cause of a loss of cognitive wellness, and that is Alzheimer's disease. So let's talk about some vocabulary. I think it's good that we come to be on the same page for this. So when we talk about memory loss, most serious memory loss, that is disabling memory loss, is really a problem of storing new information. And any of you who have spent time with a person with Alzheimer's or a related condition often will recognize this, that they have extreme difficulty with recent information, but very little difficulty with old information. In fact, they'll often guide their behaviors by old information. I'm reminded of a caregiver, a spouse that I saw early in my career, and says, Doctor, I don't think it's his memory. He can tell me everything about what he did in the Navy, but can't tell me anything about what we did last week. And she was right. It wasn't a recall problem that he was having. It was a making new memory. The other is we often see tossed around in conversation and even in the medical charts the term short-term memory loss. And that means something different to everyone. It doesn't have a single definition. For some people, short-term memory loss is forgetting why they went into a room. Or for other people, it's forgetting that they have an appointment coming up. And for other people, it means not remembering what they did yesterday or last week. So that term itself is not very specific or technical, and we try to avoid it when understanding how a memory might be affecting a person's life. Now, when memory significantly affects a person's life, when it causes them to lose or give up normal social or occupational functions, we call that dementia. And so this is a loss of function due to a change in thinking. And it's simply a description. It's simply saying this is a loss of function, a loss of day-to-day ability due to a change in intellect or cognition or behavior. So it's a symptom description. It's like saying headache. And there are dozens of causes of headache, and there are dozens of causes of dementia. And so my job as a dementia specialist is to be able to sort through those opportunities and possibilities to find out what might be fixable or what might be left if there aren't any reversible changes, and how that might influence that person's life and that family's life over the course of the next years. And then we come to Alzheimer's disease. And Alzheimer's disease is a specific clinical syndrome. So a skilled clinician can differentiate by talking and examining an individual whether the problems might be due to Alzheimer's disease or due to stroke or due to depression or due to medications, all of those being potential causes of memory loss. So Alzheimer's disease has a footprint that the experienced clinician can identify. And that footprint matches a specific pathological disorder. So there's a very clear set of changes determined under the microscope that match that clinical footprint. So Alzheimer's disease is one cause of dementia. Dementia is the umbrella term. Alzheimer's is one spoke, and a very important and perhaps the largest spoke in people over the age of 65. So hopefully that will bring us all to some common terminology as we move forward through the rest of the talk. To clarify this a little bit more, when we say dementia, it's like saying headache or saying back pain. It describes the symptoms, and there are many causes of back pain, like a slipped disc or arthritis or a fracture, and there are many causes of dementia. And in any one individual, more than one cause may be contributing. So we might see someone who has some underlying Alzheimer's disease, but then who becomes very, very sick in the hospital, a heart failure or something like that, and their memory loss gets much, much worse during that time, or they start a new medicine, and they become confused as a result of it. So the different causes or contributors to dementia can pile up one on top of another in any one individual. But when we talk about people over the age of 65, far and away the most common contributor to dementia is Alzheimer's disease. Now, I see a lot of white hair in the room. That means there's probably a lot of folks who have had some concerns about their own memory or some lapses. And they go, well, is this the beginning? Is this the first step on that pathway to Alzheimer's disease? And I want to reassure you that changes in memory are a normal and healthy part of aging, just like graying of the hair is and stiffness in the joints when you get up in the morning is. So this is changes in memory and thinking are one of the ways that the body gets old. But just like there can be relatively minor arthritis, or there can be disabling arthritis, there can be relatively minor memory loss, and there can be disabling memory loss. So let's talk about how common it is. Over the age of 65, about 3 out of 4 people in surveys will report that memory is somewhat of a problem or more. That means 3/4 of people over 65 say, my memory's not as good as it used to be, and I notice the difference, essentially. For people who have more education, high school education and beyond, the frequency of memory complaints actually increases with the years of education. So a person with a college degree may complain more about memory lapses than a person with a high school education. And the person with a doctoral training on top of that may complain more. And part of it is because probably with these more years of education, their lives and their day-to-day activities have focused more on memory-related conditions. So, you know, the lawyer arguing a case in front of the court has to keep a lot in his memory. So he's a very exercised system. And little lapses can show up. Whereas the person who has worked hard and done well his whole life, but perhaps is working in a maintenance role or something of that, where memory may not be quite as demanded in day-to-day function, may not notice minor lapses as much. Beyond the age of 75, the complaints start to drift down again. And we think that's because people start to recognize, well, I'm 75, I've earned the right to be forgetful. And so that may be what contributes to that. Memory complaints are something that we listen to seriously in the clinical practice. The more complaints the person has, the weaker their memory tends to be on cognitive examination. Now, that doesn't make it pathological. It doesn't make it a disease. But the severity of complaint does seem to track with the severity of memory deficits in detailed testing. And again, that relationship gets weaker as we grow older. So just to reassure you, if you've walked into that room and forgotten why, that's not necessarily that first step on a difficult pathway. This comes from the work of my former colleague at the University of Virginia, Dr. Tim Salthouse, a psychologist who has studied groups of people across the lifespan, so groups of 20-year-olds and groups of 30-year-olds and groups of 40-year-olds, a series of cognitive tests, memory and thinking type tests, to look at changes with age. And you'll notice that, and probably most of us recognize this, we were probably at our absolute best in our mid-20s in terms of how quickly and how sharp we could think and the kinds of problems that we could solve. You know, if someone put a calculus book in front of me today, I would struggle horribly, but I got an A in calculus in college. So those are the kinds of things that do change over time. You see this broad plateau during midlife, so between a person's 30s and 50s. There's generally very little change over that time period. But then mid-50s and beyond, there's an accelerating change with us becoming worse in our recall, slower in our speed, having more difficulty with reasoning. And the reasoning problem probably comes from not being able to remember as many components in our mind at once. And then difficulty with spatial reasoning. And that often shows up in things like driving performance. So what we've learned in recent years, and this comes from the work of Dr. Scott Small at Columbia University in New York, is that different brain regions are affected in the healthy aging process as compared to the Alzheimer's process. The areas that are affected overlap, but they're not identical. And so if we think about the brain in the head, cut midway down, just like right through the middle of the nose, and this is now an MRI scan, that has some color superimposed on it. The green stripe here, an area called the dentate gyrus, is the one that's most densely affected in the aging process. And the purple area, which is very hard to see in this projection, at the front of that memory center called hippocampus, is the area that is most affected in Alzheimer's disease. And so these are some three-dimensional reconstructions built out of the MRIs that show us that the dentate gyrus, this long strip in the middle of the area called the hippocampus, is what loses the most volume or the most cells in the aging process in a different region of the brain called the entorhinal cortex, right next door, and also fundamentally involved in memory, is affected in Alzheimer's disease. So for many, many years, we have felt that preventing Alzheimer's disease was going to give us the same benefit as preventing age-related memory loss. And now we're beginning to see that perhaps these are very different processes, that age-related memory loss and Alzheimer's disease are not the same thing. They do not have the same pathology. They do not affect the same regions of the brain. And so this has opened up a whole new area of research for us in maintaining wellness as opposed to just preventing disease. Well, if memory is affected by both, and the same general region of the brain is affected by both, and there are only subtle differences in the anatomy that even most MRI scanners can't pick up, how do we tell the difference? And this is a real challenge in the clinic. And I see people all the time who come to me saying, "Doc, I can't remember anything anymore." So how do we sort that out? And so if this is what healthy aging looks like, the beginnings of Alzheimer's disease look a lot like that for a long time. And only when the person is beginning to have more marked forgetfulness or loss of abilities in day-to-day function based on the forgetfulness can we pick up the Alzheimer's disease. So we've needed to develop tools beyond simply asking people memory questions. And this is where a lot of the research has moved toward, is in understanding the biomarkers, the biological signals in the body that signal Alzheimer's disease as opposed to aging. We have to go back over 100 years to begin to understand this. That's when Dr. Alzheimer, who was a German neurologist and neuropathologist, did the autopsy on his very first case that was diagnosed as having Alzheimer's disease. And these come from his own drawings and photographs. The case records of his original case were rediscovered in the 1990s, almost 100 years after the case took place. And so many of his original drawings have now been found and reproduced. And this is what he found in the brain of his first patient. And these are collapsed brain cells, essentially gravestones from brain cells. And the other thing he found is these clumps of protein in the brain. He didn't think it was a protein. He thought it was a starch or a starch-like substance, and it became called amyloid, which means starch-like. But in fact, we now know it's a protein. So if we look at this in a way that's a little bit easier to understand in modern terminology, if we took a very small section of brain and looked at it under the microscope with specific staining, we would see clumps of protein that are associated with damaged cell parts. These are what we call the neuritic plaques. And we would find areas of brain cells that where the internal structure of the brain cell is collapsing in on itself and forming tangled structures. So we call these plaques and tangles. And under a microscope, they might look something more like this. So this is the plaque. The little dark spots around the edges of it are the damaged areas of the brain cells. And then these darker flame-shaped areas are the areas that had been a brain cell previously, but now it's just the leftover skeleton, almost like a dead tree leaving its branches behind, even after the leaves are gone. So the traditional view has been that Alzheimer's disease is the result of the plaque. The plaque builds up, the protein, this amyloid protein builds up, and it causes damage in the brain cells that it touches. So if the healthy cells look like this, they're all literally fat and happy and smooth, and then the plaque builds up, it interrupts the connections, and the brain cells become unhappy. It signals distress, and they die. So this is what we've thought through most of the last 100 years. In the last 10 or 15 years, though, it's become clear that this is not necessarily the case and is probably not the case. The plaque may not be the problem. What we think about now is that same protein that builds up in the plaque, the one called the amyloid protein, is toxic before it gets into the plaque. So if you think about what the plaque might be, it might be the equivalent of a garbage can. It's where we've taken this protein that's built up and is in the way and put it somewhere sequestered away, like putting trash in the garbage can. And the actual toxic species is before the plaque forms. It's the same protein. It's this represented in yellow here on the screen, the amyloid beta protein. But while it's soluble, while it's still dissolved in the body fluids, it appears to be able to trigger damage in the brain cells in that soluble form. And then after that damage is triggered, the body's immune system says, "Hey, this isn't good. This is causing damage. Let's get this out of here." And it pulls it out and puts it into the plaque where it can be safely sequestered away. So the idea that we could fix Alzheimer's disease by fixing the plaques has not panned out. And we've had those studies going on now for over a decade. And in mice, it works very well, but that has not translated to people. So one of the messages that I bring to you as an audience is you're looking through the newspaper or the Sunday supplement or the internet, and you see we've cured Alzheimer's disease or Alzheimer's breakthrough once again. Start to read, and if you see the word mice, you can just close the page and put it away. We have cured Alzheimer's disease in mice literally dozens of times since 1999. The first one was in 1999. But those mice don't have exactly the same features of Alzheimer's disease as people do, and we've not been able to translate those techniques to people. Now, it's critically important that we continue to study the mice, because this is something where we can create a problem and then see how we solve that problem and then try and translate that to people. And we can do that much more quickly in mice because we can look at their brains and not wait 8 or 10 or 12 years or across the lifespan of 70 or 80 years before getting the brain. So I don't mean to denigrate mouse research, but I do think it's important that we don't leap to every time this thing helped in mice that we should do it ourselves. Now, when the story came out about champagne helping with mice, I was very willing to take that up myself. So that one I followed. And the dark chocolate I'm kind of interested in, too. But other than that, but when you see that paper, the translation from mice to humans typically takes at least a decade, just to give you a sense of that timing of how long it might take for a mouse study to translate to a human study. Okay, so if we've changed the paradigm that the plaque is the end stage and something else is active before that, that gives us a real opportunity, and it gives us an opportunity that we've had in heart disease going back now 50 years or so, and that is prevention. So from the 1960s through the 1970s and 80s, it became clear that high blood pressure was a risk factor for heart attack and stroke, and that high cholesterol was a risk factor for heart attack and stroke. So now we go to our doctor. The doctor checks our blood pressure, and if it's too high, we get a medicine. And why do we get that medicine? It's not to lower our blood pressure. It's to prevent heart attack and stroke. And the way we know whether it's working or not is because the blood pressure number gets better. Same is true for cholesterol. Probably lots of us in the room have had a high cholesterol. We didn't feel a darn thing from that high cholesterol. We felt fine. In fact, eating those bacon and eggs was really nice. So no symptoms, but a marker that said you're on your way to a heart attack or you're on your way to a stroke. And we intervened on that marker. And so that cholesterol number comes down, and it stays at a nice, healthy level because of the medicines, and then we don't get that heart attack. So that's where we're transitioning to in Alzheimer's disease. So the first thing that happens in Alzheimer's disease is that amyloid protein, represented by the red line here, starts to build up in the brain, and oddly enough, as it builds up in the brain, it acts like a sink or a sponge, and it draws it out of the spinal fluid. So the spinal fluid has low amyloid protein as the first marker in Alzheimer's disease. Now, not a lot of people are running around saying, please give me a spinal tap to find out if the amyloid protein is low. And with even if they did, we don't have a specific treatment to address that yet. And that's our biggest area of drug treatment research right now is amyloid-related research. But we can see it on PET scans as well. The next thing that happens is the brain cells stop communicating with each other as well. So this is that toxicity that I talked about at the brain-to-brain connections, and that's represented here by the yellow line. And we can see that in a different kind of PET scan. We can see that in a PET scan that measures glucose metabolism in the brain. The next thing that happens is the beginnings of those tangles, and that's represented by the green line here. So as the cells become sick and they lose their ability to process energy, the skeleton that holds them up and out in their complex architecture collapses in on itself. Only after that do we begin to see brain shrinkage. And the brain shrinkage is shown here by the blue line. I'm having little problems with the mouse. There it is. The blue line represents the brain shrinkage. All of these things are happening while the person is cognitively well, before we're measuring meaningful memory loss. And this is just like that high cholesterol. Before the person has their first episode of chest pain or their first TIA, we can measure that high cholesterol and intervene on it. So we're beginning to see those sorts of things with Alzheimer's disease. Only much later do we see changes in memory and the loss of day-to-day ability in Alzheimer's. So this is a tremendous opportunity for us to identify and intervene early, and that's where our research is moving today, is toward prevention. But the other thing we've learned is that it may not need drugs to do this kind of intervention. There may be other things that each and every one of us in the room could be doing and should be doing to help keep our brain healthy. So, Alzheimer's, before there are symptoms, this raises questions. So let's answer some of those questions. How can you tell who has it? Well, in the clinic, what we do when someone comes in with memory loss is one of the most standard pieces of testing that we do is an MRI of the brain. And so if we look at an MRI that's cut sort of vertically like this, like a book on a shelf, right through the memory centers of the brain, they're represented here by the big yellow arrows. This is an area of the brain called the hippocampus. And this black space, just at the tip of the arrows, is fluid. It's the normal fluid that's in all of our heads, but there's too much of it adjacent to the memory centers. Too much fluid means too little brain, and that's where the memory centers are showing shrinkage. And as I showed you with that set of graphs, this shrinkage can become evident years and possibly even a decade before the first Alzheimer-related memory loss. So it tells us the disease state may be present in the brain, but the person is not necessarily having symptoms from it yet. And we have grading scales that we can use, and at UAP, our radiology group has cooperated with us to get the MRI cut in very specific ways to analyze this pattern of memory loss, and that's what we see here is different stages of shrinkage in that hippocampus area of the brain in different people with different levels of memory loss. So this is a tool that we have. Most MRI centers don't do this. They don't get the cuts done in this way. It really requires some special programming. So a common question I get at the Kirkland Clinic is, well, can I just get this done at home? Can I just get this done at the local imaging center? And if the local imaging center can give me the slices that I need to do this analysis, the answer is yes. But most of them don't, and therefore that's one of the reasons we recommend people come back downtown for these kinds of scans most often. PET scans. PET scans are powerful tools. They're tools that involve the injection of a small amount of radiation into the body, and then we see where the chemical that's been tagged with the radiation goes. And in this case, we're looking at glucose. So they tag a glucose-like molecule. Glucose is your blood sugar. So, you know, when you had your glass of orange juice, it put sugar into your system, it got converted into glucose, and then circulated in your blood. Well, when the brain cells aren't working very well, they don't ask for very much energy. They don't ask for much glucose. And so in a person with Alzheimer's disease, we see regions of the brain that don't burn as much glucose. So normal, it's this red and yellow colors all the way around. That's high energy consumption. But in Alzheimer's disease, in the parts of the brain that are sort of responsible for interpreting what we know, so things like, you know, who's the 16th president of the United States and information like that, those parts of the brain show low energy metabolism in people with Alzheimer's disease. And again, in a predictable pattern. It's Abraham Lincoln, by the way, in case you were worried. But the low, and if you didn't remember, that's not a warning sign. But the low glucose metabolism in these regions of the brain is very much identifies the Alzheimer process, you know, underway. Now we can see in living people the amyloid. So for many of you, you've heard the old saw, you can only diagnose Alzheimer's disease, that autopsy after a person dies. Well, that's no longer true. We now can see the amyloid building up in the brain. We can see the plaques in the brain, not with an MRI, but with a PET scan, a special kind of PET scan called the amyloid PET. These are not generally available in clinical use because we don't have treatments to respond to them in, so Medicare and the primary insurers around the country have decided not to pay for these. There is a large research study that's underway. We're a participating site that's trying to figure out, can we get clinically meaningful information from PET scans, things that would alter our treatment plan or what we do for the person with the memory loss. But we can now see the amyloid plaques in the living person with these kinds of technologies. The next step is going to be to see the tangles. And what's very clear to us is the tangles most clearly map on to memory loss. That is where the tangles build up the most in the brain are those areas where the symptoms are worse than Alzheimer's disease. And so we are one of the leading centers at UAB with our new advanced imaging facility in tau or tangle-based PET scans, and this is just an image from that kind of scan that can show us the buildup of the tau in the back parts of the brain where that energy metabolism was low. So these are research tools, but that's how we move forward, right? We do controlled studies, we do research studies in well-identified groups of people, and then figure out how can we translate that to the person who walks into their family doctor's office and needs a medicine. So that's what we do at UAB, is try and make that translation between what's the basic science, what's going on in the mice and the rats, how does that apply to the sophisticated and expensive and hard-to-use research tools like the PET scans, and then how do we translate that to people? And so that's where my world is, my world of research, is at that interface between the high technology and the people in the clinic. And I have other partners in my research group who focus on that transition, what's going on in the mice, and how does that apply to people, and how can we test for that in people? So we've got a full spectrum of folks at UAB working on these kinds of problems. One of the things we can do, again, insurance doesn't pay for it, but we can look at the spinal fluid as well. And this is a critically important research tool. Lumbar punctures are routine procedures for neurologists. They use a needle that's about the same diameter as a blood draw. It requires perhaps some uncomfortable positioning, but for most people, it's not a significant risk to their health. And there's been a lot of negative press about spinal taps, but they are routine procedures for us in our research program and a critical element that allows us to see things like the changes in amyloid protein in the fluid and tau protein in the fluid that surrounds the brain. And so these are, as I said, important parts of our research program, but again, not part of routine clinical practice. Okay, another common question. Should I get the gene test? I hear this one in the office all the time. I saw in the newspaper there was a gene test. Should I get the gene test? Mom had Alzheimer's disease. Should I get the gene test? And the answer almost always is no. Doesn't need any more, just no. Why? Because most Alzheimer's disease does not have a gene associated with it, a single gene associated with it that gives us any predictive value. So, early onset genetically determined Alzheimer's disease accounts for only 1 to 2% of all cases of Alzheimer's disease in the world. So these are people who get it from generation to generation, and typically with onset in their 40s. Not 50s and 60s, but 40s. And in those individuals, there are known genes that we can test for that account for about half of the cases. So even in the most strongly genetically determined types of Alzheimer's disease, we can only identify an abnormal gene in about half of those people. And as I said, the onset is almost always before age 50. Those genes that are abnormal in these people are all associated with the overproduction of the amyloid protein. They're making way too much of it. Their off switch doesn't work. And so the easiest way to think about early onset genetic Alzheimer's disease is to think about Lucy in the chocolate factory, right? It's making more chocolate than Lucy can manage. And in early onset Alzheimer's disease, the genetic mutations cause the body to make more amyloid than the body can manage. And so it builds up, or it gets toxic, it ends up in places it doesn't belong, like the chocolates, it causes dysfunction. So that Lucy in the chocolate factory is early onset Alzheimer's disease. Late onset Alzheimer's disease, which accounts for over 98% of all cases, and most cases in their 50s are also, by this kind of standard, a late onset case, is not that there's too much chocolate being made, but rather that the drain is too slow. So it's the overflowing sink model. We're making the normal amount of amyloid, but we can't get rid of it quickly enough, and so it builds up as a result of that. This late onset form has been linked to more than 30 genes. After the most common one, which accounts for about 20% of the risk in this group, no other gene among those 30s accounts for more than 3% of the risk. So we would have to be testing 30 genes to account for even a small amount of the risk. So there isn't any productive value in the gene testing. We don't know what to do with the gene testing in this. And so we're still looking for those kinds of markers, but probably gene testing won't be the marker that tells us about Alzheimer's disease. Let's talk a little bit more about genes to put this in a context. Genes in our body are the material we inherit from our parents. are used to make proteins, and those proteins are often enzymes. And enzymes can make body structures grow. They can make our hair grow, our fingernails grow. They might make our skin tan when we're exposed to the sun. Or they break down substances. So as that breakfast that you just enjoyed is passing through your mouth, an enzyme is breaking down the starchy things into sugars. As it gets to your stomach, there's a different enzyme that's breaking down the proteins into the amino acids. So these genes determine proteins that have jobs in the body. And some people have fast genes and some people have slow genes. The most common example of that is in the abilities, a person's ability to manage, say, lactose or alcohol. So if we look at across the world, people who are of Asian ethnicity, Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, often have a very slow enzyme for processing alcohol. And so a small amount of alcohol in their food or drink can make them experience intoxication. Where folks from Northern Europe tend to have very robust alcohol management enzymes, and so they can literally drink more before feeling the effects. So there are fast and slow variants, and this is true across all of our enzymes. So another thing that commonly varies by genes is height. This is my family about 4 years ago, my son graduating from the Naval Academy. And you can see across my daughter, my wife, my son, my niece, and myself, there's a wide range of heights. All of us are normal. Yet no two of us have the same height. Well, my daughter and I have the same height, but we don't talk about that. So there's a wide variety. My wife and I are related to everyone else in the picture, so there is clearly a genetic link. She and I don't share a genetic link, but all of our offspring and other descendants do. So height varies. Hair color varies. And those are normal variations. Eye color varies. And the same thing happens in the brain. Some people are quick at processing proteins, some people are slow at processing proteins, and there are different consequences of those. So it's very likely that a person, in order to inherit Alzheimer's disease from their parents, needs to have several of these slower genes. And the more the slow genes they inherit, the earlier the Alzheimer's comes. Just like the fewer growth or height genes a person gets, the shorter they're going to be. There's not just one height gene, there's lots of them. And here's the critical part, and here's where this talk really hinges. It now appears that lifestyle approaches can alter the impact of these slow genes. So keeping our blood insulin low, maintaining antioxidants in our food, those are the brightly colored fruits and vegetables, and using exercise to help manage some of our blood fats like cholesterol and triglycerides, seem to be important in lowering the risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And why? It's because they can counteract some of these effects of genes. Some of the genes associated with Alzheimer's disease, for instance, have to do with breaking down of insulin. So if your insulin levels are low, that gene doesn't need to be as good. Some of them are managing transport of fats in and out of the brain cells. And so people who have poor fat management genes can't handle the fats in our diet as well. And they're at more risk for Alzheimer's disease. So lifestyle approaches can counteract these genetic risks. So that moves us toward prevention. What can each or any of us in the room do? I mentioned this a little bit earlier. Back in the 1960s, we were projecting huge numbers of cardiovascular deaths. So the projection was that by in 1960, they were projecting that there would be over 1.3 million deaths in the United States per year associated with a heart attack and stroke, cardiovascular death. But then we started to discover things like the blood pressure and the cholesterol and have safe and well-tolerated medicines, and people started to change their diet. People started to recognize that eating a high cholesterol diet wasn't as healthy. And look what happened to the mortality line, the blue line on the graph. It started to plummet. And so in actuality, there were only 500,000 cardiovascular deaths in the United States in 2000. 800,000 prevented deaths through preventative mechanisms. And I think we can take this model and apply it to Alzheimer's disease. So it's been very successful in cardiovascular disease. It took a long time to notice the change. But even now, in some of the large epidemiologic studies, like the Framingham study outside of Boston and a similar study in Germany, we're beginning to see the first inkling that Alzheimer's disease may not be on this inevitable rise that has been projected for so long. And we think the reason for that is people's recognition that diet, exercise, blood pressure, insulin, and so forth are important, and they're doing a better job of managing them. So there are a lot of risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, and there's some that we absolutely cannot change. I tell people this all the time. There are two things that we can't change in our Alzheimer's risk. Number one, we can't change our parents. And number two, we can't change our birth date. So our parents and our age are the most critical determinants that we can't do much about at all. But there's lots of other things that we could do things about, like keeping our diabetes under control or preventing diabetes through healthy diet and exercise, maintaining stroke risks as low, maintaining physical activity and mental stimulation, and the like. So there's lots of things that we can do to lower our risk, and I'm going to give you some very specific recommendations. But the most important thing is the brain is constantly changing. Our brain is not fixed. How many of you have gotten a new cell phone in the last 3 years? Okay. It wasn't easy, was it? Okay. But you got it. You managed it. There were things that were really hard when you first started that aren't really hard now. So that's the brain changing. We continue to be able to adapt, and we can use that adaptability to our advantage. So there are also things we must forget. So every single day I have something I must forget, and that is, where did I park my car yesterday? Right? And I intentionally do not park in the same spot in the garage every day. I do this as a mental challenge. So I'm in one of the big UAB garages, six floors tall, lots of parking spaces, and I try to park in the first spot that I see each time. But that's different each day. And if I didn't forget the one yesterday, then I'm going to go to the wrong floor. I'm going to be late for dinner. I'm never late for dinner. So those are the kinds of things that we can do. We can make new connections, and we can prune out old connections. We can learn new ways of doing things and forget old ways of doing things. And we all have to do both of those all the time. And so this process continues throughout life. And can we harness these processes to promote better mental function and aging? And I think the answer to that question is yes. We can harness this natural adaptability, this natural plasticity in the brain to keep us well as we grow older. I'm no longer talking about disease and stopping Alzheimer's disease. I'm talking about wellness and maintaining wellness and growing good memories and better memories as we grow older. Here's a great example in the research environment of what could be done. So this is a study where individuals, like the person you see on the screen, were put on a treadmill, and they had a navigating job. There's the virtual reality pathway in front of them, and they had to find things in the environment. This man is looking for a penguin. You can see that down in the corner. And as he's walking on the treadmill, he's steering along the pathway, and he's looking for these items. So a lot of intellectual engagement while walking. And people who did that grew their brains. Their brain was measurably larger. The memory center of the brain, the hippocampus, was measurably larger at the end of the study compared to the beginning. And it was maintained that way out through 3 or 4 months of follow-up. Now, folks who just walked, who didn't get the mental stimulation while walking, didn't show that same benefit. They didn't show the same brain growth. Now, that's not meaning that you have to be doing a navigating task on a treadmill while you do your exercise, but it does suggest there is a real role for ongoing mental stimulation and ongoing physical stimulation in our day-to-day lives. And when we can do both of those together, walk with a friend and have a conversation around the neighborhood instead of walk on the treadmill with the earphones and just listening to music, for instance. There are things that we can do that might mimic this, but we can literally grow the memory center of the brain, and this is the hard evidence that that's possible. How might it work? What do we know about this? Well, this is still a little bit controversial. I'm going to tell you what the cutting edge thinks. And the cutting edge is sometimes not correct, but this is what I think is probably going on in the world of exercise and brain health. So we have our muscles. And when we exercise, our muscles, the door to our muscles opens up, and we release a couple of hormones, one of them called insulin-like growth factor, another called FNDC5. The FNDC5 has to be cut through another enzyme to get into the brain, but once it gets into the brain, it and the insulin growth factor can trigger a hormone called the brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It unlocks the release of brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is the brain's primary growth hormone. So on Sunday, you'll open up the Sunday supplement. I'll tell you how wonderful human growth hormone is. Human growth hormone doesn't get into the brain. BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, is held in the brain and released under specific triggers. And so the triggers include things that are released by exercise. And it probably is sustained exercise. 20 or 30 minutes at a time is what's necessary for these hormones to be released. We think if we go way, way back in human history, when people had to explore to find their food, when in order to find that meal for tonight, they either had to hunt it or gather it, that time of movement looking for food stimulated the memory for where the food was or where it wasn't. And so that's why we think there's this relationship between them. So based on this work, what are the specific recommendations? Number one, physical exercise. Walking is sufficient. 150 minutes a week, that's half an hour a day on weekdays, or 20 minutes a day every day. But that minimum, it's not three times up the stairs in the morning, four times up the stairs at midday, and five times up the stairs in the evening. It's 20 times up and down the stairs all at once is what we're talking about. Light weightlifting is good too, especially because walking doesn't do a lot for our arms. Healthy diet, the Mediterranean diet or the DASH diet, both of those are available, searchable online. Those have been shown to be protective of the brain. And they focus on the brightly colored fruits and vegetables that give us our antioxidants, five servings a day of antioxidant fruits and vegetables. The opposite of brightly colored fruits and vegetables being good is that things that are white are bad. White rice, white sugar, white flour, those sorts of things are low in antioxidants. And if it turns brown when you cut it, it doesn't have enough antioxidants in it. So thinking about eating foods that maintain their color when you cut them. Ocean swimming fish have those beneficial fish oils in them. People ask me about fish oil supplements all the time. Those have not been demonstrated to be effective, but there's no reason they shouldn't be. The studies have been done with people in Europe who actually eat the fish. And then mental exercise, things like coming to lectures and creative and productive and generative activities like puzzles and games and art. Those are the things that seem to be best for the brain. We don't know the specifics about which ones work best and which ones don't, and that may vary from one person to the next. You may have seen that Lumosity just lost a big lawsuit for their claims that they prevent Alzheimer's disease, and that probably is an overstatement. But is Lumosity good for your brain? Yes, it probably is. And the other things like that as well. So in summary, Alzheimer's, dementia, and age-related memory loss are all different things. And we know that Alzheimer's is present before the dementia begins. We can accurately identify Alzheimer's through research technologies and hint at it through clinical technologies when it's the cause of dementia. But our ultimate goal is prevention, so that none of us have to walk that path of Alzheimer's disease in the future. Preventing Alzheimer's and age-related memory loss may take us on different pathways. We may need to do some things to prevent Alzheimer's disease and some things to prevent age-related memory change. But an active brain in an active, healthy body is the best way to keep an active brain in an active, healthy body. And we can all start doing that today or keep doing it if we already are. So there are a couple things going on at UAB I wanted to mention specifically, and there are flyers about this on the front table. For people aged 85 and older, we have an observation study about why they're successful. What is in their brain, in their lifestyle? What is it that they've been able to do to keep their memory well through 85 years of living on this earth? So if you're 85 or older, or you have a sibling or a parent or a friend who is, and they're cognitively well, have them give us a call. And this is a program sponsored by the McKnight Brain Aging Foundation, Brain Institute, I should say. And that's focusing specifically on people who are well and want to maintain wellness. For people who are more a little bit younger, 65 and older, we have a study in Alzheimer's prevention. So remember, I've differentiated maintaining wellness from preventing Alzheimer's. We have studies on both. The A4 study is a prevention study. It's a treatment study for people who have the amyloid protein in the brain. So a scan is done. If the amyloid is detected, then you enter into a placebo-controlled treatment trial for that to see if removing or lowering the amyloid may be protective or not. We don't know if it's going to work. That's why we're doing the study. And then there's also, for people who don't have the amyloid in the brain, an observation study following them over time to find out what they're doing that's keeping them well, with how they differ from people who do have the amyloid, and figure out what we can do to promote this kind of wellness in the future. So if you're interested or know people who might be interested in either of these studies, the flyers are up here on the front. I have a couple of business cards also for our research coordinator if you have other questions that you want to talk that the flyers don't answer. For those of you who are in the caregiving roles, have someone in your family who's affected by dementia or memory loss now, there's also a page, a stack of caregiving tips up there that you might find helpful that our experts, our nurse practitioners, who are real experts in family care and Alzheimer's disease, have put together. So phone numbers, if you need an appointment with me, it's going to take a long time. We just lost one of our doctors. It takes 7 months to get him to see me now. If you're not happy with that, tell UAB they need to hire more dementia doctors. Tell Congress, tell the Senate that they need to put more money into Alzheimer's disease clinical care. That's why there's only three of us in the entire state of Alabama, because there just isn't any money to pay for us to do it. Alzheimer's risk assessment intervention, if you want to know more about your own individual risk, that is, your memory is good and you're worried about what to do in the future, we have a program for that. And then our research studies. We have treatment studies for mild and moderate Alzheimer's dementia. Actually, the moderate study just closed. So we have treatment studies for mild Alzheimer's disease and mild cognitive impairment. Phone numbers are on the slide. And if you're okay with it, I have a few minutes for questions. Thanks for your attention. Yes, sir. Yes, that's correct. Dr. Roberson is one of our three. He's primarily a laboratory scientist. He works with mice and with chemicals, but he also sees patients with memory disorders 1 half day per week. Yes, ma'am. So antihistamine drugs, especially the more sedating ones like Benadryl, do interfere with the primary brain transmitter for attention and concentration. And we all learn in school that that's the front door to memory. So people who take Benadryl or similar antihistamine drugs, anti-allergy drugs regularly, seem to be more prone to being forgetful. And that may be a drug effect. There's no clear link between that forgetfulness and the development of Alzheimer's dementia, but it can certainly trigger the symptoms of forgetfulness. So I tend to recommend the non-sedating antihistamines. The two that are the two brand names that are out there, and I have no commercial relationship with these companies. Allegra and Claritin are the two that seem to be have the least effect on cognition. Sir? So the question is about dietary supplements. In terms of dietary supplements, there's very little hard evidence that they work. Most of them have never conducted a comparison trial. Say, if you take this versus nothing and you don't know what you're taking, that is a placebo-controlled trial. Most of them have never been subjected to that, and they're not required to. Because they're not required to, they won't, because if they do and they fail, then they lose their marketing edge. So I do not recommend supplements in general. If you take a supplement and you feel better when you take it and you stop feeling better when you stop, that's a good reason to take it. But if you're taking it in hopes of staying well, there's no evidence that says that's the case. Ma'am?
Is there a correlation between the gene of Down syndrome and Alzheimer's?
Yes, there is a correlation between Down syndrome. So Down syndrome is when you make three copies of chromosome number 21, and the gene that makes the amyloid protein is on chromosome 21. So people with Down syndrome make 50% more amyloid than they should. So they're like Lucy in the Chocolate Factory. They're making too much amyloid, and they're more likely than to get Alzheimer's disease. Ma'am, over here. So what about them? What's your question about? So any drug that affects brain function, either intentionally or unintentionally, that is as a main effect or a side effect, can have effects on cognition. On the other hand, medicines like antidepressants, if they lower your risk for depression or lower your expression of dementia, may protect your memory. So in any one individual, the use of the drug becomes a cost-benefit analysis. And there's no known link between those medicines and causing dementia, but they can lead to changes in memory and thinking that might magnify dementia or magnify other memory problems. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there a correlation between hearing loss and dementia?
Well, first of all, what you don't hear, you can't remember. So, yes. I tell my wife that all the time. But beyond that, when people don't hear well, they have to sort of slow down the world around them to process that information. So if someone who speaks quickly, a Yankee like me, I might be saying more than you can bring in through the hearing loss, and so you'll miss things. And the effort it takes to process that is effort that doesn't go into remembering it. So hearing loss does lead to cognitive impairments, but not dementia. It doesn't cause a brain disease, but it causes the symptoms. Okay, you've been patient here.
Does the number of family members that do have
So for first degree relatives, that is your parents and your siblings, the more who are affected, the higher your risk. Once you go beyond the first degree relatives, out to cousins and grandparents, that number does not significantly influence risk. So it's really those who share the most genes with you that seem to influence risk. And remember that people who share genes typically share lifestyles as well. That is, they have very similar approaches to life, very similar patterns. And what we don't know is in families, if some people are more aggressive in their lifestyle approaches, whether that's protective compared to those who don't. Sir? So the question is, do I have notes with me on the prevention tips? And no, unfortunately, I don't have those. But they're readily out there on the Internet. And if you were to search Alzheimer prevention or have someone you know, if you're not a computer user, search lifestyle tips for Alzheimer prevention, they're readily available out there. Okay. Sir? So the prescription donepezil is used to treat memory loss. That's right. It helps to make up for the losses in one of the brain chemicals, which is most prominently lost in Alzheimer's disease. But it can be used for other... Pardon? For people where a doctor has felt it would be useful, yes. It's only available by prescription. But that's an individual decision. It's not something we can say everyone with memory loss should or no one with memory loss shouldn't. It really is highly individualized for that. Okay, I'm going to take three more. Yes, ma'am? Mm-hmm. So reversible dementia means that there's another physical cause that is treatable that, when successfully treated, might eliminate the memory symptoms. So among older adults, among people age 65 and older, the most common cause of reversible dementia are medications and depression. When we get beyond depression, then pain and sleep disorders are the other two that are most common. And then very rarely things like hormone problems, thyroid dysfunction, vitamin B12 deficiencies, and so forth. But really, if we look at most common, it's going to be depression and medications, and included within medications is alcohol. Okay? Sir? So reading correlates with education. People with more years of education tend to read more, and more years of education is associated with a lower Alzheimer risk. In terms of specific preventative activities, I'm not aware of any studies that said reading is better or worse than anything else. My own impression of this is that reading is a passive activity, that it draws information into the brain, and that's not likely to be as beneficial as generative activities where you talk about what you've read, or you paint, or you draw, or you problem solve. So simply absorbing information is not necessarily as protective as doing something with the information, manipulating it in your head and doing things with it. One last question over here, sir. I am not aware of any, but that doesn't mean there aren't any. So for any specific medication, the package insert, the thing the pharmacist gives you with each new prescription, will list what was found most commonly in the clinical trials. That's a requirement of it. But beyond that, there are always going to be some people who say a medicine makes them feel sick or makes them feel dull, but it may not be frequent enough to be recognized as a typical side effect. All right. Thanks so much, folks.